Hello, welcome, and thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Aaron Diaz, and you're listening to episode number 14 of Live the Good Life from the podcast studios of Aaron's Wine Chronicles corporate headquarters in the heart of Washington wine country. Today, I'm interviewing a recipient of one of Washington State's Fantastic Four Best Winemakers of the Year. He is the winemaker for Coyote Canyon Winery, located in Prosser, Washington. He's been in the wine business since 2001, and he's created quite the pedigree along the way. In performing my regular due diligence on my guests, I became even more interested in his story after finding out that we had a connection outside of wine. I've also been visiting Coyote Canyon Winery for years, and I always walk away happy. We are going to have a refreshing chat where we're going to learn about his award-winning winemaking style and what he has planned in the future. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Mr. Justin Michaud to the show. All right.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Yeah, they really like you here in studio.
It's nice to be appreciated. You know, we all need a little applause from now and then.
Well, thanks very much for taking time out of your day to come down and join our podcast. Why don't you give us a little background and an introduction to yourself so that our audience gets to know who you are?
Okay, well, first, Aaron, thanks a lot for, first of all, coming in and trying our wines, and been a pleasure getting to meet you over the time. I love talking to people about wine and stuff. So thanks for having me here to the podcast. I'm Justin Michaud. I'm the winemaker for Coyote Canyon Winery. I've been there since 2013.
Justin Michaud.
Correct.
I mispronounced your name. My apologies. Okay.
No problem.
I'm sure you get that a lot. Michaud, right? Or whatever.
Yeah. It's my dad's a French-Canadian from the East Coast, from New Brunswick. And yeah, so Michaud is the way. A whole lot, but there's a couple out here. There's a few wandering around.
Yeah.
So I've been the winemaker with Coyote for 10 years. I've been in Washington State, since you mentioned, since 2002. And I kind of got into the wine game down in the Santa Cruz Mountains, where I did some vineyard work for about 3 years, starting in 99 up into 02 before I moved up here.
So that's our connection, the Santa Cruz Mountains.
Yes. Right?
Okay, so before we started recording, we had a little chat out in the bar. And I mentioned to you that I've spent a lot of time in Santa Cruz. I've got family, friends, went to school at UC Santa Cruz, the Banana Slug. Oh, yeah.
I know, you almost need that shirt on today.
You ever watch Quentin Tarantino movies?
Oh, yeah.
You notice that he always puts a plug in for UCSC.
He's always got a slug in there.
Yeah. So that's interesting, the Santa Cruz Mountain stuff. I mean, how do you compare, and I don't mean to divert your introduction of yourself, but how do you compare what the types of wines that you were making there or involved with making there to the ones now that you're making up here in Washington?
Is there... it was just such a different, you know, time and experience for me. I was doing work in the vineyards, at that point, and I was working in an Italian restaurant and kind of drinking a lot of Italian wines, to be quite honest with you. I think the Santa Cruz Mountains is kind of like an overlooked region of, California, that they're a little bit cooler climate and, do some really interesting wines at great affordable pricing, in that area.
Cool. So you're now full blown, you know, doing the wines at Coyote Canyon, and we'll get into some more details about your.
I've transitioned quite a bit from those days of working in the vineyards to focused more on the winemaking. I will say that being part of Coyote Canyon, when I first started, especially the first 2 years or 3 years, I was doing a lot of harvest samplings.
Oh, cool.
For us and for the vineyard. Mm-hmm. And that was just a great opportunity for me to learn more about the site, a quad, driving around all the blocks, not only, you know, sampling the fruit that we were going to pick, but fruit we were picking for other people as well.
Right.
I feel like even as a winemaker, and we'll probably all say this, we need good fruit to make good wine. So having an understanding of the vineyard is good. And, I'd spent 3 or 4 years of working in them. So I have a pretty good understanding of what's happening in the vineyards. And, I think trying to tie that picture together with how does that correlate to the type of wines that we're making? Helps you in the long run.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it gives you the bigger picture.
Right? Yeah.
So I want to thank you again for being here. It's really a pleasure having you on the show. You know, you ran into my brother and his wife down like maybe 5-6 weeks ago or so. And Adam says, yeah, I was talking to Justin and I was telling him about the podcast, and he said that he watches it and he'd love to be on it. And so you went over apparently and turned it on the TV or something. You got it going.
YouTubed it up.
Yeah. Adam came back and he goes, oh, this guy's got to be on the show. And I'm like, yeah, I know Justin. I'll just ask him. I haven't been there in a few weeks or a few months. I'll go down there. So that's how this happened. And I really appreciate you taking time and coming down. But you know, we have a tradition here in the studio. And typically what we do, it's customary, traditional, whatever you want to call it, for us to have a libation.
Yeah.
Now, when I'm dealing with winemakers or people in the wine industry, we always crack open a nice bottle of wine.
Yeah.
If it's somebody else, so a lot of times we're doing scotch or we're doing, you know, whatever the case is. But today—
I drink scotch too.
Do you? Well, the next time you're on the show, we'll do that for sure. This time we decanted a special treat from Col Solare. The wine today is a 2018 Tanuta, which is 100% Cabernet Sauvignon, and it's sourced from the Red Mountain Estate of Col Solare, and it was crafted by Daryl Allwine. You know, before we get really rolling on the interview, I want to get your thoughts on this wine.
We did take a sip out there at the bar. Yeah. So it is fantastic. I mean, Col Solare is producing some amazing wines here in Washington State, and you know, all Red Mountain. I love going up to the winery itself is beautiful, and just those vineyards are all really, really interesting around there, where they've got some high density plantings. And I know this is 100% Cabernet, but I'm not totally sure, you know, from what sections of their vineyard it came from. I understand they're getting all, you know, estate fruit now.
Right. And you know, there's that, they have that four corners where they've got four different clones that meet, like 2, 6, 8, and 10 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the Tanuta comes from just one clone, or if it's, I would imagine it's probably the creme de la creme of the lots of one or more clone, more than just one clone, I think. But
that's a good question. Giving them a great like blending opportunity, right? It's all Cabernet, but you got some different clones, some different spacing in your vineyard, trying to sort of drive different flavor profiles and create something. So Daryl's great. I'm pretty. You know, excited to know he's just retired.
He did.
We're actually doing a little project with him and Henry Earle.
Oh, okay.
To kind of help them get started. So, yeah, I'm actually excited to kind of work with him a little bit on that project as
Cool. So, he did a Tom Brady and came out of retirement and kind of.
I think he's, you know, doing some friendly consulting.
Yeah. Well, good for him. Yeah. Good for him. So, Justin, I'd like you to kind of go into a little bit more detail about who you are as a person. I want to hear about your family, where you grew up, maybe, you know, some high school, college experiences. Did you do any prison time, you know? How was that worked out? Whatever you can tell us, you know, give us a little bit about that background.
Charlie, well, so we know we got the Santa Cruz connection, and I grew up in Virginia, and I was born in Connecticut, moved down to Virginia. So as mentioned, my dad is Canadian, and my mom grew up in Louisiana. So I kind of got the deep South, mixing with a bit of, you know, the Canadian North, and they settled in the middle in this cool little enclave town called Floyd, Virginia. It's a one little stoplight town, you know, in the Blue Ridge Mountains. You're 5 hours from D.C. and the coast. And,
is that where they filmed Deliverance, by chance?
It might have been real close.
Okay. I'm dating myself. People don't even know what that movie is these days. I talk to people.
But we actually, the Floyd had, at the time, I didn't appreciate it. I go back now. It's amazing. They got a Friday night jamboree with all the locals playing, you know, banjos and fiddles and all that good stuff. Yeah, that's as a kid, cool. Of course, I couldn't, you have a hard time dragging me down there. But yeah, amazing musicians and a lot of artists live in that area. And my parents ended up starting a health food store in that town. So I think kind of growing up, I just kind of always appreciated, you know, organic food, health food, trying to, you know, a lot of people in this town were growing their own gardens and, you know, how could you sort of live off the land? And I think in a way that, you know, as equated to what I do now and, you know, with wine making and grape growing, how can you grow, maybe not necessarily organic, but thinking about the sustainable stature of things and how to like care for what we're using so that, you know, our kids can use it in future generations. So
you got that Santa Cruz blood in you. Yeah. Even though you weren't originally from there, right?
totally. Like another little spot that I just fit into perfectly when I moved out there. Yeah.
So tell us about your wife, how you met her, about your kids. You know, you have any pets? What kind of hobbies? What do you do when you're not, you know, doing what
not,
you normally
doing
do?
What I do? Yeah. Well, I do have a wife. My wife, Kate Michaud. I met her in Santa Cruz, and mm-hmm. she was actually the catalyst for getting me into the wine industry.
Oh, okay.
She had moved there to pursue a wine profession and mm-hmm. was working with Bonnie Dune Vineyards.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was going to mention Bonnie Dune.
Yeah. Well, super cool. You know, Randall Graham there is mm-hmm. doing some amazing things with, you know, different Rhone varietals and in a weird, kind of abstract way, what Mike has done with our Coyote Canyon Vineyard, where we're mm-hmm. up to 31 different varietals planted and, you know, really interested in, you know, testing new things and figuring right. out, like, okay, will we do that well, but how can we do it better?
And for the audience, Mike is Mike Andrews of Andrews Family
Vineyard. Yeah, so that's our owner would be Mike right. Andrews, yeah. So Santa Cruz was great. So I met Kate there. She was doing, starting this wine job with Bonnie Dune, and I had, I was a surf bum to get real.
No, all right.
You went to, for the
so
many
where did you college. Where did you surf down there in the center? Did you go to La Selva Beach? Did you go to?
Well, I lived on Seacliff, the 38th for a while, so okay. I would surf the east side yeah. down there. Yeah. You know, a lot of the point, and then I had right. some good friends out in Davenport, so I would drive to Davenport a lot and kind of surf out of town,
right?
Just
right.
to you know cut down on the crowds a little bit.
Yeah.
The water is so cold there anyway.
It is.
I think it's an awesome place to surf because the cold water keeps the crowds down a little bit
mm-hmm.
and just a lot of great breaks. Yeah. So I love that. And, but was not going to be a professional surfer. Kate, my wife, had some friends who was starting a new vineyard company. And the great thing about that was a small startup company. And, if there was a big swell in, I could probably skip that day. So, you know, an understanding boss who was from that area. So that's kind of how I met Kate and got my start in the wine business.
So you guys have been married for a while.
Yeah, 20 years.
20 years. Wow.
This year's our 20th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Cheers to
that. Yeah, cheers to that. Okay, so now, you know, the suspense is finally over. We're getting to know who you are. I did my research on you, and then I found out that you did some time in New Zealand. Not hard time, just wine time.
Yeah, wine time.
In New Zealand. And so you've had international experience. You've had domestic experience in different terroirs, right? I mean,
yeah.
tell me a little bit about your experience in New Zealand.
Well, I think, just a little bit more about me as well. Like, I love to travel, and, I'm like, anywhere new that I can go, mm-hmm. I want to go.
Yeah.
And part of what drew me to the wine industry was this opportunity to travel, you know, 20 years ago before I had kids, a little bit more flexibility.
Right.
And really to like learn in this industry, you know, you can do multiple harvests in a year and so much happens during our harvest period. You know, we're making, you know, is it 60-70% of the impact of you know what your final product is going to be happens in this 2-month period. So if you go to the Southern Hemisphere, New Zealand, Australia,
Argentina,
yeah. you know, all those guys are harvesting the opposite of us, right?
Right.
So you can come here, harvest September, October, you can go there and harvest March,
right.
April, and you can do two harvests a season.
Did you do that? I mean, was there a period of time where you actually did that for a little while?
Yeah. So this was when I was meeting Kate. So she got mm-hmm. a job in 1999 to go to Western Australia. So we went down to Margaret River
mm-hmm.
and she had a job lined up at a winery. And I didn't, but I went with her for 3 months and worked at a lavender farm. I picked grapes.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of made some side hustle cash money
and she
worked the harvest. And, when I got back from that is when I really dove into the grape growing opportunity. And we found the chance to go back to New Zealand later on. So yeah, mm-hmm. I've done a harvest in Australia, New Zealand.
Wow. So you've had a lot of hands-on stuff. I mean, you've had a lot of hands-on, you've probably been mentored and everything. Do you have any formal wine training, certifications in enology or viticulture or anything like that? Or was it all just immersing yourself in it and learning from the people?
I've all been, kind of immersed in it. And when we moved to Walla Walla up from Santa Cruz, and I was making the transition from vineyard to winemaking, I took some courses at the community college, but it was like a compressed 3-day analysis kind of course. So I think I might have an old certificate for that.
I just asked because it's all over the board with people that I talk to, people that I interview. You know, I mean, you cannot gauge the success of a winemaker based on their credentials. You can't do it. I've met some of the greatest, you know, winemakers around the Northwest and whatever, and some of them just learned on the job. Some of them have credentials from UC Davis and so forth and all this other stuff, right? So it's just all over the spectrum, right?
It is all over the spectrum. I think it's actually, these last 2 decades, it's become a little bit easier to get the schooling.
Right.
You know, 20 years ago when I moved up to Walla Walla, that was the first community program in the country to start a viticulture and enology degree, you know.
Right.
So kind of like our wine making and growing region up here, the wine teaching is also relatively new. So I think we're starting to see more people coming through these programs in school. But also, I was talking to some people about the Yakima Valley Community College, and they're saying, that they were having a hard time getting some of these kids to finish their degree because they were finding a job before they were done with their schooling.
Yeah.
And you learn so much on the job, you find a spot you like, you're like, okay, well, I'm going to go there and take this full-time position. You end up with a little schooling, a little practical experience.
And you know, the wine industry is being successful when it's starting to drive the evolution of other educational institutions like the WSU Wine Science Center that's right here in the Tri-Cities, right? You know, they've got students that they're training for all kinds of different things as well. And they've got technology there, labs and the whole bit.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to have that kind of thing. So
it is really good. Yeah.
So my next question is, you know, over the years, you've been in the sphere of a lot of different folks, right? Folks in California, folks in New Zealand, folks here in Eastern Washington. Who has had the most influence on your winemaking skills?
That's a great question. I think it's for me, since I've sort of learned on the job this whole time, it's been trying to sort of gain bits of information from different people throughout the years. You know, when I was first kind of starting in the cellar, I didn't really know if it would become a career or not, right? But you're learning a lot those first year of harvest on setting up pumps and stuff. And then as I got more into it and became more interested in what was going on and wanting to, you know, to become a winemaker without going to school, you know, I was really trying to like pick each guy's mind a little bit about, okay, so why is it this barrel that you like?
Right.
I was fortunate to work at a couple of larger places, and you know, Kendall Mix has been a guy that I've worked with at a couple of times, and really respect.
I really like Kendall's winemaking style. Believe me.
Yeah. And just a good person.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To that. When I was in Walla Walla, my first head winemaking position was with the Ash Hollow Winery, which is no longer there. But we had a consultant, Steve Clifton, out of Santa Barbara region in Santa Ynez Mountains. And I learned a lot from him because I was making the wines. He was the consultant winemaker and would kind of come up and guide. But he gave me a lot of, you know, great advice when I was at my first, you know, winemaking job. And am I implementing these things correctly? So it was kind of nice to have him at that early stage to sort of know where the wines were going and to have this vision of place. And then, you know, I worked with the Goose Ridge Winery. We had a couple of great winemakers.
So when you were with Goose Ridge, were you there when Kendall was there?
I was, I was kind of the crossing guard. So it was Charlie Hoppus's last year. So that was really cool, you know, because Charlie's a Washington icon.
Right.
You know, makes incredible wine. So it was great to get a year to work with him. And then Kendall Mix came on board. Right. And so it was nice to tag back up with him again.
Those were the years when I was a club member down there at Goose Ridge, and I just loved the wines.
And Brandon Rice was there at the time. He's a great guy. He's doing a lot of good stuff here in the state as well. Cool. You know, I think we've and from the wine biz, we talk a lot about Chateau Saint Michel being the wine school of Washington. And yeah, I think that has been evolving and changing as some of these other players have come up. And yeah, you know, looking at some of the folks that that I work with at Goose Ridge or have succeeded at other places, they're doing really, really great stuff. So it's cool to see.
Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, when you look at all of the things, the roles and the responsibilities that you have as a winemaker, what do you think is the hardest part of making wine? Is it dealing with what nature gives you every year? Because it's, you can have all the recipes you want, but things change on a year-to-year basis,
things,
right?
Things do change.
Nature is part of that.
Nature definitely part of that.
What do you think is the hardest?
I think it just changes, you know, for different people, it's going to be different things. Part of what brought me to the wine biz was the harvest. Like, I really kind of like the, there's a little bit of chaos involved with it as all of this stuff is, you know, you're picking grapes and you're trying to empty tanks out and make space for the next batch.
Yeah.
And, you're trying to create symmetry and balance out of all of this madness, and that's when you really start to love the team you're with. You know, you're at the winery 7 days a week and you're tasting grape juice, you're tasting finished wines, and you're working with the morning crews and the afternoon crews. And each like winery is its own little community during this harvest period.
Yeah.
So I really like that. And I think it's the hard part can be, I mean, now I'm at such a small, you know, Coyote, it's basically me and my assistant, you know, doing all the work. At a bigger place, I think some of the issues are just keeping that morale up, right? After you're 3 weeks into working 7 days a week, you know, most of us have kids and, people get tired and stressed out and stuff. So it's finding that balance, I think, can be, is really important. Because it's something you love to do, so you don't want to lose the focus of like, hey, I'm trying to create something that I love here. I know it's Sunday. I'm not watching football, but I'll be watching it in 3 weeks.
No kidding. Hey, I'm excited about the new season. Please don't talk about the Seahawks on this podcast, though. We do not talk about the Seahawks. It's all Dallas Cowboys right here, baby.
I think we might have a bigger rivalry because I'm a Washington fan. Yeah.
You're a Commanders? I almost said Redskin, but you're a Commanders fan.
I want to be a Redskin fan again.
Yeah, they've had a rough time. They have had a rough time. They've gone, that's a whole other podcast. We could talk about football on another podcast as we're eating some steak and drinking some wine.
Boom, right.
We can do that. So if you had to name one person in the wine industry, anywhere in your last 20 plus years of being in the wine industry that you admire, who would that person be and why?
That is another great one. That was one of the ones I was like, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's loaded.
Is that
it's a loaded question because, if somebody asked me in my career that question, I would have to think there are a number of people who have influenced me in my career as a scientist, over 34 years, right? I mean, so I'm asking you that question.
Yeah. I might have to circle back to that one.
Okay.
I think it's, like I was mentioning earlier, I've kind of worked with different people and glean different pieces from them.
Right.
And, I love about the wine industry is that there is this sense of camaraderie between other wineries and other places, right? They were building this community together and, you want to, they're interesting people that you like to hang out with.
I've seen that on Red Mountain. And talking with the folks who are in the middle of harvest, something happens and somebody has a machine that breaks and other wineries, other teams come to their aid and help them out through the harvest.
Yeah.
And that's really cool. I don't know that they do that in other competitive regions like Napa. I mean, do they? Maybe they do. Maybe they don't.
Yeah. I don't know much of that is going on. I mean, I'm sure there's a little bit.
But I mean, in Walla Walla and in on Red Mountain and the Yakima Valley, I've heard a lot of stories that, we help each other.
Totally.
So that's cool. Yeah.
And we've got that where we are, out in Prosser, where our tasting room is, the winemaker's loft and, the Vintner's Village. There's 10, 11 tasting rooms. We're not all producing wine there, but, a few of us are. And, we've definitely borrowed a forklift. Needed a bin, couple of clamps or something, and it's nice to be able to run across the street or holler at somebody on the phone and be able to stopgap fix the problem.
What's one of the biggest surprises that has taken you as you're in your winemaking activities? You know, what surprises you the most in your job?
I think, you know, it's sort of like a combination. Now that I've been doing this for a while and I've been with, you know, Coyote Canyon for 10 years, mm-hmm. that I've got a real, you know, sense of what is coming, you know, real comfort, and, mm-hmm. You know, stability and kind of how we're operating and moving through. So I think sort of like it might be the perception of what a winemaker does or is. And I think, you know, depending on what size winery you're at,
yeah.
you know, that changes quite a bit. What is the winemaker doing? You know,
it's, right.
At Coyote Canyon, I'm greeting people at our tasting room a lot of times. I'm, you know, making blending decisions. I'm ordering glass. I'm, you know, I'm doing a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
But at a bigger place is a winemaker that not necessarily your role, you know, maybe.
And they're not the face of, I mean, they don't want to be the face of the, some of them don't yeah, want to yeah. be the face of the wine to the customers. I really like it when I go to a winery like Mike's, yours,
uh-huh. yeah, you yeah, know, yeah.
because you give intimate attention to the customers. You'll come out, you'll go through the tastings with us. And it's just, I love that. I love having that ability to engage with the person who's fabricating
yeah, yeah.
the stuff that I'm buying that I love, right?
Totally. And I love to, you know, to harp it up, to chat a little
yeah,
bit, right?
Yeah.
Like you're back in the cellar for 5, 6
you're
hours.
You're kind of a people person,
out,
though, right? I mean, you're a people person,
I'm a
right?
people person.
Yeah. I can tell.
So my wife, she's a little bit different winemaking style. Like
okay.
She kind of preferred to be behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Like she's great logistically and
yeah.
wants to organize things and make great wine.
Yeah.
But she doesn't really want to go out and tell you why she's doing it and
yeah.
how she's doing
right,
it.
Right, right.
And she's like, it's fine. I'll just make the wine and you guys go talk about it. And yeah, I like to make it. I like to get out there and, you know, eat the steak, drink the wine with it, and kind of experience all of that.
So I don't know if you've ever done one of these at your winery or not, but so at various wineries that I've been associated with, as far as either a club member or just visiting the winery often and understanding their events and things,
yeah,
you hear about these wine glass tasting
totally, yeah,
the events, tasting, right? So the Riedel or others, you know, whatever, and they'll, you know, the shape of the glass for specific wines, bringing out and amplifying aromatics and you know, enhancing flavor profiles if they're fabricated properly for the wine that you're drinking.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one thing that I'm not a big fan of drinking wine out of Dixie cups, mason jars, you know, a stemless wine glasses. I don't like that. You know, I'm just, maybe I'm a nerd, a wine nerd. I don't know. But, and then I started getting into certain types of glasses like Zalto. I really like the Zalto wine glasses, especially for the Bordeaux varietals and
yeah,
those
yeah.
kinds of things. And so now, you know, I ask this question of a lot of winemakers, you know, to you, does wine glass design and shape really impact the experience of the wine?
I think it's like twofold. And maybe we're going to talk more about this, but I think like for me, the importance is like consistency. So if I'm at a wine judging or if I'm blending, I want all the same glass. I don't want 3 different glasses because mm-hmm. I think that's because I believe a glass does change your perception of the wine.
You do. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, you've got, I mean, I've done one of those tastings before with the Riedel and,
yeah.
you know, you definitely notice a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're at home, it's pretty easy to do this test on your own, you know, put a glass in a red Solo cup, you know, and a wine cup
yeah.
and smell them.
Yeah.
Like you can hardly smell out of a plastic
right.
cup that's straight sided.
Right.
And our olfactory, our smell is really,
it's tied to the taste.
Majorly tied to the taste.
Right. You have a cold, yeah. you can't even taste.
No. So you need those things to go.
Right.
And I do think the different glasses, you know, will change that. So that's why I'm talking. Like for me, it's more about if I'm tasting 3 wines, put them all in the same glass, and you're going to
yeah.
have a better understanding of how those wines relate to each other.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if it's whatever, it's a Chardonnay and a Cabernet, you could put them in different glasses, right? You
right.
put one in
right.
the right glass.
Right. But I mean, if you're doing reds, if you're looking at reds,
yeah.
you know, yeah.
Yeah. That's, I think that's the key. And I go mm-hmm. back again to like the blending or the making factor, right? If
mm-hmm.
I'm blending 4 and I've got one really nice red cab glass, that cab probably going to taste better than the other 3 cabs I'm putting regular wine glass, right? I'm
like, right, right.
Man, that's the base. So yeah, you just want that same glass. So you're getting the same experience of each wine you're tasting.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
My next question is kind of a hypothetical situation thing, right?
Totally.
Okay, so
desert island.
Yeah, no, you have your favorite red and your favorite white in front of you. What would those wines be? I know it's a loaded question because when people ask me what's my favorite winery, I can't answer the question.
Yeah.
Because there's too many of them.
It's hard.
And then what's my favorite wine? It depends on my mood. I mean, totally. There's so many factors, but yeah. I'm posing the question to you anyway. If you had to choose one of your top favorite reds, one of your top favorite whites, what would they be? And what would the ideal food pairing be with that white and with that red? I'm really interested in food pairings with wines, both on a personal level and for the audience, because we do talk about food as well, culinary, cuisine, totally. High-end cuisine. And so I'm always looking for the best pairings I can to convey to the audience.
Yeah, I know. And I think it's, people love that too, right? I think that's a big turn on and key to the wine.
Wine is food, really.
Wine is food, yeah. It's an extension of the dinner plate, right? And you look back to, Europe and, regions that have been drinking wine for a lot longer than us, that, it's a higher per capita consumption rate.
Right.
They're having a glass with lunch.
They're starting at age eight.
They're almost eating and drinking. They're almost not drinking.
Right.
Like if there's a glass of wine, there's some food there. There's bread. There's
they don't cheese, start eating until the wine is open.
Yeah, so it's that combination.
You saw Goodfellas, right?
Oh, yeah.
where they open up the wine and you're like, okay, now we can eat.
Now we can eat. Oh, yeah. That movie was great. Great stuff. So I think that's a big factor.
Okay. Next question.
The wine, I was thinking about this, and it is. It's such a hard question. Like, what is your favorite wine? Because I love working at Coyote Canyon because I make 20 different wines. Right?
And we're going to get to that in another question. That spectrum is just
I got like the ADD.
Amazing.
I like Sangiovese. I like Barbera. There's Cabernet over there. So.
Right.
But I think like the one wine that I've sort of like consistently gone back to is actually a sparkling wine would be the Bellecart Salmon Rosé. Mm. And it's not that that's like the best rosé or anything. Sparkling wine, but it's really consistent. It's really good. And I've had it at a couple of special occasions. Mm-hmm. And then, when my wife and I go out and we're, treating ourselves or something, that has been a wine that I've, experienced several times over the years, So I think that's what makes wine special almost is who mm-hmm. you drank the bottle with.
True.
And where you were. True. Like if I was just drinking this bottle there, Cole Solari by myself on a,
I like sharing. You got to share
it
with somebody.
Same, right?
No, it's not.
You're opening it, you're chatting with someone, and then you're like creating a connection to that wine that's deeper than just, that's a great bottle of wine that scored well in people.
And then when you have a memory, you connect the wine to the memory of what you were doing.
And then you smell the wine again and you can, remember that. So I think kind of that. I have got like a really big house palate. It's just hard. Yeah. As a winemaker. I'm, making
But what would you pair
wines.
With that wine that you just mentioned?
That'd be like oysters.
Oysters.
Yeah,
okay.
Boom. Clean and simple.
On the half shell.
On a half shell. Mm-hmm. Little bubbles and oyster. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be the way to go.
Okay.
Go with that.
And the red?
For the red, I'm just super, super into Washington. So if I was like to pick something, outside of Washington, that I like and enjoy, I'm just a big Nebbiolo fan.
Love Nebbiolo.
They're hard to find here in Eastern Washington because we don't have, really diverse wine shops that are giving us a really nice selection of other ones. But, if I'm going out to the city and, go to a good wine shop, that would probably be my go-to to find a nice bottle of, Gabuti Barolo and enjoy that. Those are, they're like a red meat wine for me, so I'm thinking a nice steak.
I'm with you.
Kind of deal like that. And that's probably, one of my favorite pairings is, good red wine.
Yeah.
Nice cut of steak.
Right. Not well done, hopefully.
Oh, please don't well done. I'm like maybe medium. It's probably medium rare.
Yeah, medium rare.
That's the way to go. But
so, here's another question, and it's interesting. I have to ask this. Some people think it's a no. Never mind. But to breathe or not to breathe a wine, I have had conversations with people who are expert wine people, have decades of wine experience underneath their belts, and they have flat out told me You don't need to breathe a wine. As a matter of fact, if you're breathing a wine, you can breathe it too much. And yet, well, yeah, you can breathe it too much if it's breathed for 3 days and it's, you know, you're not covering it with argon or whatever. But so what are your thoughts on breathing wine? Do you prefer things like an aerating nozzle or decanters or those kinds of things? Or do you just, are you totally fine with just popping it, pouring it, and drinking it?
That's a great question. I mean, like from the, you know, like a tasting room perspective, you're getting people in.
Yeah. I mean, you have no choice. Room. You have no choice in that respect.
Yeah.
So oftentimes, right? You're popping them. You got people. You got to pour them.
Yeah. And oftentimes I think that's how most people are drinking our wines. You know, you're an exception. Like you love wine. You know, probably most of the people watching this podcast are maybe the exception as well, right? Like you're a little bit more into wine.
I rarely just pop a wine and start pouring it.
Right.
Yeah. Because I plan in advance, but maybe I'm OCD about that. But I mean, if I know people are coming over, the wines, I've opened up 3, 4, 5 bottles of wine. They're sitting in decanters.
Yeah. Right? So I think you're the abnormal.
Maybe,
I think you're
probably right.
I think you're coming from a different box, right? We're getting a lot of people in our tasting room and they like wine. You visit tasting rooms, you're next step up, right? You're like wine a lot. You want to learn about producers. You want to go taste them and stuff. So I feel like for that instance, I kind of want them to taste what they're going to get at home. So if I felt like most of our consumers had the time and were thoughtful enough to decant things, there's a few wines in our lineup that I would decant. But then the tasting room aspect as well is we're possibly pouring that wine over a 2 or 3 day period.
Exactly.
You know, if it's during the week, if it's not a Friday or Saturday. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
You're not covering them all with argon. I mean,
we do argon.
Do you? You do.
Yeah, we got a little argon.
A lot of wineries don't.
Yeah, we do because we have so many that we want to argon. And again, going back, like we want the customer to taste the wine as close to it's going to be as when it was just opened, you know?
Yeah.
So, really, even in that aspect, if I am decanting a bottle, like we do these library wine tastings sometimes or verticals, and I will taste something. I'll be like, man, that wine's going to be better. Let's maybe I'll decant it and then decant back into the bottle.
It's just, to me, it's just as a scientist, right? I'm a sensor. I work in sensor physics, right? So our body is a sensor. I've talked about this before on other podcasts. Uh-huh. And when you're tasting and smelling and you're experiencing that wine, you can measure. You can quantify the changes as something breathes. You can physically measure as it breathes the changes that you're going through, both from an olfactory perspective and a palate perspective.
Yeah.
And so I know that it makes a difference, but when people tell me it doesn't or that they just don't want to do it, I think, why not? Because most every time when I'm breathing a wine, I mean, there are some wines that you don't want to breathe a whole lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but.
Well, you get some older wine sometimes. Yeah, like you might not want to decant a 10-year-old bottle because it's getting close to oxidizing anyway.
Right,
you know, so,
so
if you do decant it, you kind of won't be ready to drink it.
Right.
You know, so that's one where maybe you pop it and you pour a glass and you're like, is it good? Do we aerate this? I think.
Agreed.
You know, a lot of people don't have the opportunity either. They're not buying 2 bottles of wine and decanting one and tasting a regular one next to it. But I think that's the way I learn. Best is like, you know, seeing things, touching things, tasting things, not like, well, next week I'll decant that bottle. You know, like, well, it's a week later. You're opening another bottle a week later. You didn't decant the first one. You decant this one. But how do you feel different? What, you know, what are you eating? What, you know, all these things play into
it. A lot of variables,
So if you really want to know, you kind of got, like for me, I kind of do it side by side. Be like, well, okay, here's aerated one, here's non-aerated one.
Yeah.
In the winery, I do have that luxury, right? I can pop a bottle, a big chunk.
I've done
cab,
that. I've done that very experiment.
Wait 3 hours and pop a new one, and we can taste those, and we can talk about it. And then, you know, I think that's great for our staff as well, because, you know, they're not making the wines. A lot of people think winemakers just know this, but I wasn't formally trained. Like, I learned this over doing it.
Right.
You know, like, okay, I drank a bottle that was not decanted, not aerated. It was fine. Like Washington, we have very fruit forward, big, full, rich wines that, you know, are drinking great without being decanted.
Right.
But, you know, decanting them can open them up more, you know, give you a different variation of them. So,
you know, you're pouring wines at your winery that are much older than typical wineries.
We are.
And you do pour the babies too, the ones that are just, you know, two, three years.
Our whites are, you know, predominantly all.
Yeah. Brand new. Yeah. And I'm really impressed with that. And my next question kind of goes to this. And So when you're making wines, you know, some people like me who are collectors of wine and who like to sit on a wine. I don't mean that literally. I'm just saying, you know, I like to put it in my cellar and let it age.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll taste it right out of the bottle. And, you know, when I'm sampling it at the tasting room,
totally.
If I love it, I'll put it in my cellar, and I want to usually buy more than one bottle.
Yes.
Like to buy three or four, totally. Right? Great. If I really am into the wine.
Great advice.
And then sample one every year and a half or two and watch how that evolves.
Yeah.
And so doing that, I kind of get an idea of what's happening with the wine as it ages. And oftentimes, of course, you know, you're going to get this nice increase in experience, you know, with the wine. So when you're crafting a wine, how do you determine as a winemaker what that, you know, when you're marketing that wine, you say, well, this wine's going to be good for 10 to 14 years or 6 to 8 years, maybe if it's a Rhone style varietal or if it's a big tannic, you know, Bordeaux varietal, you know, oh, this could last 20 years, you know, and you see the Robert Parkers and the Jeb Dunnocks and all these guys and they're posting those parameters out there on the wines as they grade them.
Yeah.
You know, they're saying, hey, this wine drinks from 2025 to 2034 or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a scientist. Give me the technical justification behind that. I know that it's not an exact science. I know that you can't say that 14 years down the line, this wine's going to drink optimally.
Yeah.
But you can say, based on my experiences, the range could be a 5-year range from 8 years to 13 years or something like that. And you could be pretty close.
Totally.
Well, but how does that happen?
Europe's been doing it for centuries, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You start to understand what producers have a history of creating wines that age well, right? Like I think Washington, we're still a really young slate. It's hard to find a 20-year-old bottle of Washington wine. I mean, I don't know how many you've got in your cellar. I got a couple, but I mean, not many, right? So I think even understanding, you know, we're writing this stuff down as well. Our wineries, you know, Coyote Canyon 2004 was our first vintage. So, you know, I've been able to taste some of the 2004 wines that they produced, you know, moving forward. That's 19 years old now at this point, right? So I think for my determination, you know, like personally, has been tasting these Washington wines from different producers and trying to hold on to some and tasting them later in life, you know, and then it gets complicated. Like, you know, what type of closure was it? You know, what, you know, for me, when I'm putting together a wine, you know, new oak has more tannin. So you're building up more tannin, you're giving more oak component to a wine. So that's, you know, potentially adding more ageability to a wine versus a wine aged in a neutral barrel. Right. So when we're putting together, when I'm making our reserve blends, you know, my HH series, our artist series, those wines, we charge a little bit more and we anticipate, we want them to be more ageable. So those are getting a higher percentage of new oak in them, right?
Right.
And then kind of my core tier Coyote Canyon wines that we want to keep, you know, moving through, you know, those are a little bit less new oak. So we're trying to, you know, bring that fruit forward a little bit more, have them more drinkable.
More approachable right up front.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can pair them with lots of things like hamburgers and pizza and ribs and that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. So the winemaking is going to play a role on that ageability. And then how you're blending things together, right? You know, so I mean, Cabernet has a history of aging really, really well, you know, because it has nice tannin, has all this good stuff. So if you blend a little bit of Cabernet into some other wines, maybe it's helping your ageability. But like, how much is 7% Cabernet extending?
There's just too many parameters.
So many parameters. And then I think like aging might be the ultimate one. Like if you're buying it from a winery, like hopefully that winery has bottled the wine and put it into the correct temperature and aged it that way.
Oftentimes you see wineries, tasting rooms, having tons of wines out in the tasting room on the shelf.
Yeah.
They're not stored horizontally. They're vertical. And they go through the fluctuations that the room goes into. Right.
So tasting how fast rooms, are those swapped?
Exactly.
Where are they pulling your bottles from?
Exactly.
Is that making a very
When I see that, I kind of question, you know, hey, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everything that I do is, you know, at a specific temperature, and we keep it that way until we crack it open.
Yeah, So I think that's a huge you know, you look at the old French houses, right? They're like, they're all underground cellars, you know? It was like bottled and then moved down to some 58-degree cellar. until they pull it out and give it to you. So yeah, I think that can be a huge a huge impact.
So cork or screw top?
They're both great. I mean, I got no problems with screw tops. Love them on our white wines. Mm-hmm. Love them on red wines that you're gonna, you know, drink within a 5-6 year period. I think, like, you know, basically the U.S. market, I think we still have a perception issue of screw cap being cheaper or lesser value.
Yeah, doesn't necessarily. I mean, it's not necessarily true. I've had some screw top wines that are. I mean, really good.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little bit old school myself. I prefer pulling a cork from a nice bottle of red. I prefer using real cork when I can and where we can in our program. I mean, for the white wines, to be honest, I kind of prefer screw cap on them. Mm.
You can put them back in the fridge and open them up the next day or 2-3 days later and still have a nice experience. And having the screw cap on, instead of having to push a cork back down into it or whatever, and then sometimes you push the cork in too far and you can't get, you know, what it's like. It's like, okay, well.
Got the opener back out.
Right.
For high quality, high-end stuff, I mean, I still think, real cork is the best way to go.
So tell me what makes Coyote Canyon so special in your mind. I know you're biased, but I mean.
Definitely biased. I mean, I love the Horse Heaven Hills. When I first moved to Walla Walla, I was working at Canoe Ridge Vineyards. And, you know, that's a Horse Heaven Hills site, you know. So we were working with a lot of Horse Heaven Hills fruit at that time. And, I worked at Goose Ridge, we were working with fruit from around the state, and, you know, a lot of different AVAs. I mean, the Goose Gap, the original stuff, but some other vineyards as well. And I appreciate fine fruit and wines from all over the state. I mean, here we are drinking this nice Red Mountain stuff today, and it's beautiful. They've all got something unique to them. What I really love about the Coyote Canyon Vineyard and site is, you know, the Horse Heaven Hills is, like most of Eastern Washington, is hot and dry, right? So we're not getting a lot of rain out there. So we're, and we've got really, really great east to southwest facing slopes. Mm-hmm. You know, A lot of vineyards are slope, but a lot of Horse Heaven Hills is a little bit flatter ground that things are planted on. So I think the location of the Coyote Vineyard is just really amazing, where it's got a lot of great sloped areas for it. And then the consistency, you know, which I think is one of the things that is great about Washington, is we're just, every year we're going to get great fruit. I mean, it takes a good team together, and you've got to, you know, make sure that you're doing everything when it needs to be done. But the weather cooperates with us. We get these long, hot, dry summers. Mm-hmm. You know, here we are, we're cooling off a little bit as we come into the fall. And maybe we'll get a little bit of rain. You know, typically we'll get 3 days of rain in September and October. Mm-hmm. You know, that might push picking back 3 days. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's idyllic area. And I think, too, you know, it kind of briefly touched on this. Washington is so young. You know, our vineyard is 30 years old, the oldest plantings. So I think that, you know, we're still have a lot to learn and, you know, potential to access here in Washington as our vineyards kind of get a little bit older. I think it's somewhere around this 20-year mark that you start getting a slightly different, you know, flavor profile. You've been training these vines for 20 years. You're getting closer to, like, the natural setup that you've been aiming for. You know, we're shooting for 3 tons per acre, and initially it's giving you 6, and, you know, come year 20, it's 3.5-4 tons an acre, you know, naturally, and you're just kind of cleaning it up. I think that's kind of what excites me a little bit about our vineyard, that, you know, we've been working with really amazing fruit, but it should continue to evolve. And, you know,
well, whatever it is, you're doing it right. I will say that.
Thanks.
I'm a big fan of your wines, Justin. As long as I've been visiting, you know, you guys have been considered a small production winery with respect to the total number of cases that you're putting out. And you already kind of mentioned that in the previous discussion. But, you know, what always impresses me is the diversity of your wines, which we've kind of alluded to. You know, you craft a wide range of wines, and it's just amazing how many varietals you use, combinations and blends that you create. And the consistent quality of those wines is really, really good. Yeah, that's what's really impressive to me. So can you talk about your lineup of wines for this year right now, and kind of maybe highlight some of your favorites?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big pull for me to come to Coyote, as a matter of fact, was the diversity in the lineup. You know, that there's just some things that you're not seeing everywhere. So the Albarino was a big pull right away. You know, I've worked with a lot of other grapes, but had never worked with that varietal before, and I've always really enjoyed it. You know, again, you know, you're looking at the Vino Verdes, you're looking at Spain and Portugal making these Albarinos that are great, light, acidic, you know, seafood wines. And here we're getting a lot more like depth of fruit profile. And in our site in particular, I find the Coyote site is a little bit warmer than where some of the other Albarino is planted in the state. So we get a slightly different, almost a little tropical note mixed in with the grapefruit and citrus stuff going on there. And we've been making that same varietal in our concrete tank and a stainless steel. So for me, it's been really interesting to see how the vessel is, you know, impacting the wine. I'm looking to diversify our Viognier program. I think, you know, now that I've been doing this for a while, we're really heavy on, you know, fruit forward wines. We want to express the terroir. So we've kind of stayed away from any, oaked white wines, but we've added Sauvignon Blanc and Marsan, and, you know, we've been doing Roussan and Viognier and Albarino. And, last year I did our Viognier with a little bit of, oak, just kind of like a flash couple weeks in barrel treatment and then back to tank. So I kind of like to incorporate that into our program and have one wine that is, you know, showcasing the balance of, you know, fruit and oak, in our program. And then the reds are just a ton of fun. I mean, like, I'd never made the Graciano before, which is a killer.
Tasted that just the other day.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when I called you that day, I had just seen your award up on the wall. And you were out of town. You were...
I think I was back east.
Yeah, you were back east. And I either called you or texted you. And we were doing a tasting. And I forget the lady's name who's there.
It was Joe that day?
I think it was Joe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. We went through... We tasted... 18 or 19 wines.
Oh, yeah, Joe.
It was amazing. I loved it. We just kept going and going. And she would pull out other wines, and we would do like little mini verticals or side-by-sides. And it was just like one of the best tastings I've ever – it's totally impromptu. And I mean, those are the experiences that I live for. I just love that.
Totally. And I think that's I think that's what kind of our brand excels at giving that opportunity, you know, if people are there and they want to. Like we want – you to taste all of our wines if you can. I mean, you know, a lot of times six wines is all you want to taste. But we've often got 10, 12 wines open and, you know, people come into tasting rooms to taste wine. Yeah, like we want you to taste.
It was quite the experience.
Why is this wine different than that wine? And the verticals are super fun to do. And
So I know this next question is kind of loaded, but I want to talk about barrel aging and cooperage. And I like to ask this question of winemakers because I get different answers from different winemakers. And, you know, you obviously have probably a few cooperages that are your favorites to work with. I know there are a number of parameters that go into choosing that, you know, the toast that you want, the flavors that is that are imparted into the wine, the cost up on the per barrel basis, because they can be very expensive.
Barrels are expensive.
You know, so can you take us through how you choose different barrels and toasts and talk about the aging parameters for say an example wine, maybe the HH Cab or something, you know?
I mean, yeah, I think it's
the Big John.
It's a great question. You know, I think we talk about, you know, being a winemaker is a combination of art and science, right? There's a lot of science that goes into these, and then there's a little bit of art behind it, you know? And I think the barrels, I've heard them, you know, referred to as the spice rack of a winemaker, right? So it's one of the, you know, more impactful tools that we have that are going to sort of drive our wines in one direction or another. I think for me, this is what I've really appreciated about working at different facilities and getting to work at some larger facilities is the, you know, ability to taste a lot of different barrels, you know.
Right.
I buy 20 new barrels a year, and I'm like, really need to be pretty precise about that, you know, making 20 different wines, you know, I got like 14 different red wines that I'm making. So I want to try to match up, you know, the barrel with the varietal, which I've had some learning, you know, experiences here at Coyote Canyon dealing with new varietals. So when you get something new, you know, you can research that wine a little bit and see, you know, where did it come from? Maybe find out, you know, ask some other people who've made it, what did they use for it? you know, the Cooperage guys, they love to talk barrels too, right? Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm buying barrels from like 8 different guys, you know, and I'm only buying 20 barrels. Mm-hmm. They must hate me. He's like 2 barrels at least. but I think each barrel is a little bit different, and
right.
I want to, I want to frame my wines the best I can.
Right.
I want everything to be unique and different, you know, so I don't want my Sangiovese to taste like my Barbera. They're coming from the same vineyard site, so there's going to be a little bit of similarity across our wines.
Yeah.
So creating barrel programs that sort of help, hopefully help elevate that in particular varietal while also adding some, you know, unique characteristics that will help me, you know, really distinguish each wine that I come up with. Something like the HH, you know, I mean, Cabernet is a nice wine for me because we make a little bit more of it. Mm-hmm. So I have a few more new barrels in the program.
Right.
And for me, even when I like find my favorite barrel, and I've got a couple I really like with Cab, mm-hmm. it, like I still want to experiment with, with the new one, right?
Yeah.
I'll be like, well, what if I put one barrel of this in there? So that's a little bit hard for me to do just because I don't have the volume to do it.
Sure.
So I have kind of honed it down into what I feel works. And then each year I will try to experiment with maybe one or two barrels somewhere within my lineup. But, you know, now I've been doing this for 10 years with Coyote, I do have a pretty consistent regime.
Right.
I think maybe a couple of interesting things is, you know, I find our Barbera works pretty well with American oak. I'm a heavy French oak guy, probably, 90% French by like 2 American barrels out of the 20.
Okay.
I like one on my Barbera and I like one in the Tempranillo. I think both of those wines show well with a little bit of that. You know, the American oak seems to be a little more vanilla, a little more sweet tones to it. And pops a little quicker. And both of those wines, I tend to age a little bit less than my, my reserve stuffs or Cabernet, Malbec, by bottle them, 4 or 5 months earlier. So that American is, you know, a little more aggressive. So I get the punch that I want out of it for those.
Well, so back to the winery, what kind of future events do you have happening that you can tell us about, like maybe coming up in the fall
or
do you have any
stuff,
summer stuff going on? What can you?
Well, we're just wrapping up Wagest as we record this.
Right.
This will be released in September. But September is a great month to come to wine tasting because, like I said, we just started harvesting. You know, you've come and done the tastings. We love to bring out grape juice during harvest, a fermenting wine. You know, I think it's not only is it fun for, the consumer to get a chance to taste wine in that stage, it's just a really, really great connection point for us. If we are like fermenting red wine, we try to take people back into the back room there and let them see, you know, what does a ton of grapes look like when it, you know, what is the stuff happening before it happens. So there's a balloon rally that comes up.
The Prosser balloon.
Rally. So that's a really fun weekend. We usually do a vertical tasting for that weekend. We've got coming up, and then October we have a wine club party for our wine club members early October. And then we do a Catch the Crush where we do a grape stomping event at the tasting room. We got a music, bands playing, a couple of food trucks. So that's that second week of October. And again, it's just really great because you get, you can taste wines, finished wine products. You also get to taste a little bit of grape juice, a fermenting wine, and then, the grape stomp is just a really fun event.
Yeah. What would people be surprised to know about you, Justin, that they don't know?
That is a great question. Well, I mean, we learned a little bit more about me. You know, I used to be a surfer when I was living down there in Santa Cruz. I didn't mention I love to ski. We've talked a little bit about it. I'm a big travel guy. I love traveling. I didn't really mention my kids, but have 2 daughters that both of them are, my youngest just head off to college this year. So I got 2 kids in college and it just feels like a really, a great point in my life, a kind of transitional with the.
So we have another connection. I've got 2 daughters as well.
You got 2 daughters as well? Yeah.
22 and 26.
Oh, right on. Yeah.
So, yeah.
20 and 18.
Yeah.
A couple years ahead of me.
Yeah. But I'm an old man, so,
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you think is the biggest challenge facing the Washington or the Pacific Northwest wine industry right now?
Well, with we got some interesting news coming out of St. Michelle this past week, with as far as like what's going on with Washington, with some of our large producers and growers, that has maybe made me change my initial answer to this. I did watch a couple of the other podcasts and know that you like to ask this question, and
yeah.
It felt like a couple of the other guests were spot on with. Kind of where we are, like, how do we really
identity, kind of thing.
Get our identity out there.
Right.
And, what does Washington do well? This past couple of weeks, it just seems like there's a lot of, changes in the global wine industry, mm-hmm. And how will that impact us in the Pacific Northwest is yet to be seen. I think, Washington is really interesting because we are built on small wineries. My perspective is a little bit different because I spent some time in California, not a long time, but I felt like the average winery in California was closer to 20 to 50,000 cases. Mm-hmm. And here in Washington, it's 2 to 5,000 cases.
Right.
Came and moved up and worked with Canoe Ridge Vineyards, people thought that was a giant winery. And we were like, it's kind of like a average, maybe even small size winery.
Right.
So I think there's like this perception, you say, oh, hey, I make wine, 5,000 cases sounds like a lot, but it's really not a lot on the, on the big scale. So, mm-hmm. Maybe our biggest problem is identity, but I think it might come back to like, how do we group these small wineries to represent Washington on a national scale? Like Coyote Canyon is not big enough to sell our wine in every state in the U.S., right? But like every state in the U.S. wants wines like Coyote Canyon. They want these unique small producers that are getting good scores. Yeah,
the boutique wineries, right?
And we can't all be everywhere, but seems like there's enough of us that have some room for distribution.
Right. If you got enough people together, there's power in numbers and you could put something together where you could distribute those wines elsewhere.
So it's maybe trying to figure out, how do we really capitalize on all these small wineries? Because we're not California. There's not that many people here. Like Napa's got like 16 million people a couple of hours away. Like we just don't have that population.
And 14.9 million of those are millionaires or billionaires. Yeah. So
So we're a little bit more isolated in our wine grown region out here. Yeah.
So what are you most looking forward to in this next vintage? Harvest is coming up, right? So
harvest has started.
So what are you looking forward to out of this?
I'm making my sparkling Albarino again. So, I only make all that every couple of years.
Yeah.
So that's cool. I get to pick Albarino a couple of weeks early. So mm-hmm. it's neat to see how the finished wine comes out at that, 19 brick stage versus 21, 22 bricks. I've already picked that. It just started it fermenting. So that's exciting. I've been kind of into the Rhone stuff, the Grenache, the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking, really looking forward to that. It looks really good out in the vineyards.
I really love a nice Grenache. I'm a big fan of a Petite Syrah too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but there's not a lot of those around in Washington.
No.
I mean, they're
we got California. 31 varietals, but no Petite Syrah.
Well, there are a few, just a couple, but.
Oh yeah, Davenport does that Darif, mm-hmm. it's like Petite Syrah. Mm-hmm. And Wade Wolf does a blend. Yeah, there's mm-hmm. a couple out there. Yeah, no,
and there's
I'm a big fan
Plain Cellars does one. That's
Plain.
Bad.
Nice.
It's in Leaven. They have a tasting room in Leavenworth and out there. But
it used to be Garrett Grubbs was their winemaker. I don't know who's their winemaker now, but I went out there when he was there. Yeah, that's a cool little spot. The Plain Cellars.
Well, I before I get to the next part of this interview, I just want to let you know that I have to congratulate you again personally on receiving the Washington State Fantastic Four Winemaker of the Year Award. There were four of you. I know that Victor Palencia was one and you were one, and I don't know who the other two were, but it's a prestigious honor and one that is well deserved, Justin. So congratulations to you for that award. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, no, totally. It's it always feels good to be appreciated by your peers. Yeah. No, that was a nice phone call when let us know we were one of the Fantastic Four this year. I think it just says a lot about even though we're a small winery, we're really consistent and we're producing mm-hmm. some really high quality wines.
Yep.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot about you this afternoon. I know the audience has learned a lot about you and your winemaking approach. I appreciate the opportunity hosting you today, Justin. So before we go, I'd like to give you the opportunity, you know, to the audience, go ahead and plug Coyote Canyon Winery again. You can talk about the hours, about the things that the events that are happening, where you're located at, how easy it is to get there right off of Highway 82,
boom,
you know, going east or west on 82.
That's right.
If you're coming from the west side and you're driving to Red Mountain or Walla Walla, stop in at Prosser.
So
this is your opportunity to plug it again.
Right on. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks again for having me, Aaron.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure. So our winery is located in Prosser, Washington, where it's a great spot. There's a Wine Country RV park there if you want to go camping. You know, a couple of nice hotels in the area. The food scene in Prosser has come leaps and bounds the past couple of years. We've got some really nice restaurants have popped up, doing a great job in there. We're one of the few wineries that is open 7 days a week. We close for like three holidays a year. the rest of the time we are open in there, Monday to Sunday, 11 mm-hmm. to 5. We've got some great music events that we do. Our new Wit Winery has moved in the next door to us. They're doing some really fun big concert series.
Yeah.
We have a great barbecue event in June that comes through the loft area. So, yeah, there's just a lot of fun stuff to do. We've got a killer wine club. We do two shipments a year of six bottles. We're small, so we've got a red, a white, a mixed club. It's easy to swap wines, get whatever you want in there. We do pre-select for you, new releases, artist series, reserve wines, some regular stuff.
And your bottle prices are really reasonable, too. That's what I really like. You're getting high quality for great bottle prices.
Yeah.
I mean, you really are.
We're trying to over-deliver.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing it.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you giving that plug. You got to go visit Coyote Canyon Winery for sure if you haven't already. I'd like to thank you for joining us on Live the Good Life, Justin. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure.
And that's all we have for today's episode. Again, for more of Living the Good Life, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Aaron's Wine Chronicles or online at aaronswinechronicles.com. And for a video podcast version of the episode, visit my YouTube channel at the @ Aaron's Wine Chronicles 6666. So, again, thank you all for listening. And remember, wherever you go, whenever you can, always live the good life. Until next time.